audio. A movie in your mind.
Unmasked, a prequel short story. In Dave Swavely's upcoming novel, Silhouette, Michael Ares is a war hero, hired and given a license to kill by an autocratic regime determined to keep the peace in a post-quake San Francisco of the future. He faces a gauntlet of trials on his way to either death or glory, including the impossible dilemma of investigating a murder where all the evidence leads back to him. This is the story of an episode from Michael's past that is mentioned in Silhouette and comes back to haunt him during the events in the novel. And it is a story about some fine lines that are very hard to walk.
Karen Reyes was convinced that the man sitting at a table in the Embarcadero Plaza was the killer. Something about a mask, which she would explain to me when I arrived. So I parked far enough away and stayed out of his line of sight as I walked to her position. Many of the citizens of San Francisco knew my face, and the man would definitely recognize me if he was a piecer, as Reyes suspected, because that would mean we worked for the same company. The term piecer, which had become the post-quake moniker of choice for our law enforcement officers, was considered ironic by our critics, and would indeed prove to be so in this case, if it was one of us who murdered and mutilated three people in cold blood, especially if those in charge of him were okay with it. Reyes was a piecer herself, and a good one, who had proven trustworthy through years of experience with the Bay Area Security Service, BAS for short. So I had taken it very seriously when she told me her theory about the perp being an employee. Seriously enough to ask her to keep it between us at this point, and seriously enough to leave the castle to deal with it myself. I wasn't on the streets as much as I used to be, now that I was an executive piecer, so it felt good to strap on my guns and possibly see some action for a change. And as it turned out, I wasn't disappointed. As I made my way toward Reyes's position, I slipped my glasses on and reviewed the news report, if you could call it that, that she had sent me, which was a big part of my motivation to handle this myself in a discreet manner. Bass's most vocal critic on the net had the same theory as Reyes, but for different reasons. Unless he was just lying and using the murders as an excuse for more of his blatant propaganda, which was quite possible. Either way, Harris was a PR problem waiting to happen. He was the leader of a group of revolutionaries, we called them squatters, who invaded and made their home in our Red Tunnel, one of three big ones in a system of underground passages that Bass had installed in the months following the quake. The tunnels snaked out to various parts of the city from the 30-story above-ground headquarters we had built on the top of Knob Hill, known affectionately as the Castle. The access provided by the tunnels was a key tool in maintaining order in the city and establishing our authority over it in those early days. It's a good thing we developed better ways to mobilize, because this one was now controlled by a twisted version of Robin Hood and his merry band. Within days of their invasion of the Red Tunnel, Harris and the squatters had impressively managed to overhaul the power and water systems so that they could live in that portion of the tunnel, and they had armed themselves sufficiently so that the only way we could remove them was by lethal force. And since they had already been flooding the web with propaganda against us, and now from right under our nose, Bass leadership made the decision to leave them there, at least for the time being, rather than make them martyrs. One example of such propaganda was the video of Harris that I was now watching in part of the view inside my glasses. I had seen it earlier when Reyes first sent me the link, but had to review it again because it was hard for me to understand everything that the freak was saying.
From today and from the sacred dawn of modern media, aka the century before this one, bringing you some more tabloid dirt on the big ass and their Nazi tyrant, and this one hits close to home. You know, I get by with a little help from my friends. Some of them were doing a milk run into the city by the bay, and they never came back.
Harris's tattoos stretched out toward the viewer and morphed into pictures and videos of two naked bodies, one male and one female. They were inked all over like he was, but with gaping wounds and drying blood interspersed with the body art. The male body had been castrated, and the high-res, close-up images left nothing to the imagination.
You may have total recall that on December 6th of last year, we found the corpse of one of our fellow civil rights champions in a crime alley in the city. She was martyred to a god no one believed in.
The last line was from a popular prisoner song that I actually recognized, unlike the last one. But I was pretty sure the lyrics had nothing to do with how he was using them.
Some of us are handy dandies with ballistics. Remember, I was a piecer, insert laughter, myself at one time, and others among us have worked for the COPs too.
When he said insert laughter, as he always did when he mentioned the word piecer, he also made the gesture that he was in the habit of thrusting out every time he said that word, the index and middle fingers backwards, then just the middle finger. It had become so effortless by now. He probably did it in his sleep when he dreamed of his former days at Bass. And when he mentioned cops, one of his tattoos became a shaky handheld camera view of a policeman accompanied by a song with lyrics that said, bad boys, what you gonna do when they come for you?
So we showed you how the bullets that killed our Newsomer almost surely came from a Bass gun. Her only crime was buying food, giving us this, our daily bread, and she ended up like a Slimer in Ghostbusters. Who are you gonna call?
If the woman who died was indeed one of the squatters, I thought, then buying food was not her only crime. Everyone in the Red Tunnel was breaking numerous laws by invading and living on our property.
So after we exposed this billionth abuse of authority by the so damn insanes who run this city, the next mercy killing, meaning they killed another of our angels of mercy, was done by Mac the Knife instead of a gun. And now the third man has gone missing and no body has been discovered yet. We obviously pulled back the curtain on the Wizard of Oz, so they had to change their modus operandi to keep us from more proof of what we all know. That these piecers, insert laughter, are trying to silence us one by one. The silence of the lambs. Speaking of the Wizard of Oz, again, cha-ching, they're too much like the Cowardly Lion to come in here and face us all like men. So they have to wait until we're alone in the dark and act like the serial killers they are. That's all a so-called piecer is, you know. He's a psycho killer, qu'est-ce que c'est? Fa-fa-fa, fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa.
I turned it off, though French words were probably easier to understand than his media speak. But I knew why he did it. He received money from the advertising departments of the big entertainment companies, credited automatically to his accounts every time he made reference to one of the products they produced or distributed. Plus, I'm sure he simply enjoyed the fetishistic integration of the popular arts into his life, as all super geeks did. Especially the entertainment of the 20th century, which to them was the sacred dawn of modern media, as he had called it. Now the only window open in my glasses was the one on the top right that showed Reyes's position relative to mine, so I rounded a building and went into a side entrance until the two blips were next to each other. Then I moved my finger on an arm of the glasses until the tracking window closed and the brightness increased, so I could see her better in the dark restaurant. It was closed in the middle of the night, of course, but she had requested access because it afforded the best view of our mark and of the elaborate monument he was sitting near. The original version of Valancourt Fountain had been completed in 1971, a 40-foot high and twice as wide conglomeration of long square concrete tubes that twisted around one another. 30,000 gallons of water were pumped through the tubes from the pool at the bottom, then poured out of their open end to start the cycle again. The water had been shut off by the city several times to save the high electricity costs, but protests always brought it back until it was finally destroyed by the earthquake. The art value of the fountain has also been highly controversial. Some considered it a gross monstrosity, and others thought it was unique and daring. Saul Rabin, the founder of Bass and current dictator of the city, also known as the mayor, had been one of its fans, probably because the sculptor was from Quebec, the city his parents had immigrated from. Saul had also proposed to his wife at the fountain, so he had it rebuilt after the quake. And he rebuilt it twice as large and ostentatious, as a symbol that San Francisco was better now than before he came to power.
Thank you for coming, sir.
She was an attractive Salvadoran woman, older than she looked, if the water cooler gossip at the castle was to be believed.
Did you watch Harris's shtick?
Yes. He blames Bass every time a squatter is killed or goes missing, of course, which happens to criminals all the time without us helping them along. But this time you think he might actually be right. So tell me why.
The last known sightings of the victims in the first two cases were here in the Embarcadero area. One seen by a witness walking out at the plaza, and the other captured on a surveillance camera while waiting to board a ferry on the nearby docks. So, I staked out the plaza and saw this.
I opened a link that had just appeared in the glasses, and half my view was now a surveillance video that Reyes had recorded with her own pair. This was one reason why net glasses were standard equipment for all pieces, because video recording was so crucial to our work, and external cameras didn't have the infamous blinking problem that went with contact lenses and optic cyberware. If you blink, you might miss it, had been a very effective advertising slogan for the glasses and goggle companies. The video showed a thin male figure emerging from inside the Valancourt fountain. The original had three walkways through the tubes, and this new version many more. Then it highlighted a larger male figure following him as he headed toward the water and the famous ferry building, a landmark that had also been rebuilt after the quake, its clock tower duplicated, but its bayside building now fitted with a parking lot on top and large bays down below for the ferries, which were an important means of transportation and commerce before the Golden Gate and Bay Bridges could be repaired. The ugly neon sign facing the bay, which used to say Port of San Francisco, was now replaced with a permalight one that said City-State of San Francisco. The video rewound abruptly to the frame where the man's figure was the largest and zoomed in on him. He was wearing one of those solid headpieces that extended down over the eyes to house a pair of net glasses. They were sometimes worn for decorative purposes, somewhat of a fad, but more often to conceal a TMS coil that was marketed as a substitute for drugs. It could be activated to treat depression and other chemical imbalances in the brain, but also for recreational use. The headpiece looked like the top of Batman's cowl, but without the ears protruding from the top. The man's clothing was nondescript, but that didn't mean anything, because mine and Reyes's were too. We piecers seldom wore uniforms, because we had high-tech ways of recognizing one another, and preferred to intimidate criminals with the idea that we could be within reach at any time.
I wasn't sure at the time whether he was really following him to the ferry, and I was merely watching for patterns, so I didn't tail them. But when I heard that a third squatter was missing, I played a hunch and checked the bus tunnel maps.
I raised my eyebrows as the video disappeared from my glasses, surprised to hear a report go in this direction.
I found that there's a small tributary from the Red Tunnel that stretches to underneath the fountain. It was sealed a long time ago, but I'm thinking that the squatters reopened it and have been using it as a secret passage to the city, perhaps especially when they want to ride the ferries without being surveilled.
That made sense, because I knew Harris's people were involved in a lot more crime than he ever admitted. Who knows what they were smuggling across the bay, especially from the ruins of Oakland.
So that's why you're thinking the killer could be one of us?
Yes. I suppose some other scenarios are possible, like intra-squatter conflict, but there's only one that seems probable, from motive and opportunity. Three bodies are too many for this to be random or accidental. I think they were executions, and I think he's waiting for the next one.
She nodded toward the figure at the table in the plaza, which looked a lot like the one in the video, especially when I telescoped the view in my glasses and saw that he was wearing that same kind of headpiece. So I decided to trust her instincts long enough to let my mind go down the route she was suggesting, imagining that a piecer was killing defenseless squatters one by one without authorization. This wouldn't be the first time something like this had happened. There was a fine line between legal and illegal murder when the cops had a license to kill. I was silent for a while.
What are you thinking, sir?
I'm thinking what I would be doing if I was the killer.
The different MOs in each case are hard to explain.
Maybe he's learning as he goes. Just like Harris had suggested. I thought a little more about the delicacy of the matter.
You've done good work, Reyes. I'd like to test your theory on my own.
If the killer ran, I thought I knew where he'd run to.
Take up a position at the entrance to the ferry building parking garage.
I stepped back outside and walked behind the buildings, out of sight from the perp again, but toward the other side of the fountain. As I did, I called the castle and asked for the best tech available, and soon an older, gray-haired man named Nathan Aaron was on the line.
Mr. Ares, how can I assist you?
Only do what I ask, not the usual global data searches, and especially not PISA locations. Depending on what happened,
I didn't want others to know if the killer turned out to be Bass, and for a number of reasons, I didn't want there to be a record of it. And I didn't want to take the time to go through the whole database in my glasses, so I'd have to find out who he was the old-fashioned way, by taking him down and questioning him. Scan the Valancourt fountain in the Embarcadero for surveillance devices. The tech was good. He came back on in just a few moments.
There are camouflaged micro cameras at each of the exits and one near the center.
Can you tell whether it's Bass equipment without seeing to whom it's registered?
It doesn't matter, sir, because it is definitely not Bass equipment.
This threw me a bit, but then I realized that a piecer could simply have purchased his own in order to avoid the kind of confrontation that I was about to have with him. Can you hack the cameras without the owner knowing? And give me access too.
Are you kidding?
Soon there were five tiny screens visible in the left half of my glasses. By now, I was standing on the far side of the fountain from the perp. Loop the camera at the closest entry point. I switched my glasses to night vision and walked into the corridor. There was no one else inside the fountain at this late hour, the homeless having been effectively scared away by Bass's zero-tolerance policy. But I knew that during the day, many people, especially children, enjoyed the maze-like adventure of viewing the fountain from inside. It was engineered so that you could see the waters from almost anywhere in the walkways, and you certainly could hear them well. Come on, Michael. After making a few turns, including a wrong one that ended in a blank wall, and some winding steps downward, I found the camera that was watching the squatter's hidden tunnel entrance. While Aaron had it temporarily looped, I located it on the wall near another dead end. It was a clear strip stuck to the concrete, about the size of a band-aid or a stick of gum.
Sir, the camera is equipped with night vision as well, and a proximity alert.
While its owner couldn't see me, I explored the floor near the dead end and discovered the tunnel entrance, its outlines hidden by tiny, hollow projectors near the corners that looked similar to the camera on the wall, but were even smaller. It would be interesting to find out how they opened it from this side, probably by remote, but that wasn't the reason I was here right now. I crouched on top of the tunnel entrance, turned my head slightly away from the camera, and told Aaron to release the loop. Then I stood and moved slowly past it, like a squatter emerging from the tunnel. I could almost hear the proximity alert beeping in the killer's ear, assuming Reyes was correct in her theory, and this wasn't just a wild goose chase. I crouched near the end of my little hallway, so I was able to make use of either corner, depending on which way the perp came. I moused the arm of my glasses to arrange the camera feeds so I could tell which entrance he used. Aaron, watch him. Then, I waited. The masked man didn't move from his seat in the plaza, which I expected because if he was the killer, he would be waiting until someone emerged from the fountain. He would be watching the same camera feeds I had in my glasses to see which doorway I exited. But he continued to not move for such a long time that I started to think this was a wild goose chase. Then he stood up and moved toward the fountain. Bingo!
The perp is using the north entrance and will approach you from your right.
Right. I'll take it from here. Aaron, unplug and give me some privacy. I maximized that camera view at that entrance and watched as the man pulled a handgun while entering the fountain. It looked similar to the two boas I wore on my belt, which were the weapon of choice for many pieces, but I couldn't tell for sure. Still crouching, I leaned on the corner to the side he would be approaching and placed one of my boas on the floor so that the sight pointed in that direction. Then I accessed the sight wirelessly in my glasses so I could stay behind the corner but see around it. I switched the other boa from killer rounds to stoppers and held it ready to fire around the corner. The gun sight's view was looking down a long corridor that eventually reached another dead end. This was the basement of the fountain, but there was an opening in the right side with steps leading up. I could see the far end of the bottom two steps and knew this was an ideal setup because the perp would have to step off them when he entered my line of fire, the laws of physics guaranteeing that he would be at least slightly off balance when I fired on him. My idea was to knock him down and perhaps disarm him with a few stopper rounds, they were very good at that, then question him, and if he was a piecer, try to untangle the ethical knots that would present. If he was some other kind of criminal, it would be very simple. Arrest him and lock him up in the cathedral that was also on top of Nob Hill, which Saul Rabin had turned into a high-tech jail after the quake. And if the masked man resisted arrest, I would shoot him with the killer rounds in the other boa. That was the legal kind of murder in our new world order. Any notion of simple went out the window when I saw a proximity alert flashing in one of the tiny windows from the other perimeter cameras, and soon realized that a couple of lovers had been strolling by and decided to walk into the fountain. They were heading in our direction and could easily overtake the perp, which would complicate things considerably. So now I knew for sure that I needed to take him down as soon as he arrived, and before the couple could be caught in the fray. Thankfully, he arrived at my position before the couple did. I couldn't hear him coming down the steps because of the sound of the fountain waters, but I could see him plain as day when he stepped off of them into the hallway. That seemed a bit clumsy for a piecer, but he may not have been at the top of his game, especially if he was being medicated, and he certainly wasn't expecting his prey to be expecting him, let alone ready to shoot him. I extended the bow I was holding around the corner, down low near the sight on the other gun that I was looking through, and fired three times. I could see the unmistakable blur of the stoppers as they each unfolded into a rubbery X shortly after they left the gun. Damn! But I could tell right away that he was not incapacitated, and that he might have held on to his weapon. The unsteadiness of my bent wrist and the awkward angle of the gun sight camera were to blame, but I hadn't been ready to risk getting shot myself. Stopper rounds against killers was not a fair fight. So, I wasn't sure what to do at this point. Until I heard a scream from around the far corner and up the stairs. Great. The masked man now had the couple as hostages, and the higher ground, so I probably should have let him leave to make sure of my own safety. But my military and police instincts prevailed, and I picked up the killer boa, switched it with the other in my right hand, and moved out into the hallway. I was halfway toward the opening to the steps when I heard the perp's voice from them.
Who are you?
Michael Ares. I prepared to move much faster when I reached the next corner. He paused after I said my name, which may have meant he was a piecer, but maybe not, because many of the criminals knew me as well.
Don't follow or identify me, because my authorization comes from higher than you. And I know you will not fire again while I'm holding these two.
While he was speaking, I dove across the opening with my head pointed up the steps toward him and rolled out of his sight when I hit the ground on the other side. Then I quickly curled up and crouched near the corner so I could fire around it again if I needed to. What I had seen in that brief second of reconnaissance was him standing at the top of the stairs, holding the two women in front of him by their collars, with his gun over the shoulder of the one on his right. My frantic mind flipped through my options, which weren't many, but he made them all moot with his next move. A tiny gas pellet bounced down the stairs, already emitting its gray fumes into the air around it. It landed a few feet from me and stopped spraying, but I had to move back along the wall behind me toward the dead end, because the gas was slowly expanding in my direction.
We're leaving! If you want to live, wait till the gas dissipates. Or if you hold your breath and try to run through it, you'd better go the other way, because I'll be dropping more behind me.
I thought it unlikely that it was lethal gas, which was very hard to come by, and this stuff looked a lot like the kind that we used to knock out criminals. But I couldn't be sure. Nevertheless, I stepped quickly away from the gas to the dead end of the hall, then stepped back quickly to the corner. I peered around it until I could see that the perp was gone from the top of the stairs. I followed the trail of gas through the twisting corridors until I ran into another dead end. He had thrown a pellet down that hallway to misdirect me. I turned back and became increasingly disoriented in the dark, the gas distorting the night vision in my glasses and perhaps fogging them too. I tore them off and had to feel my way with the one hand that was unencumbered by the glasses because I was covering my nose with the other one. My lips and teeth started to hurt because I had been clenching them together so tightly. Finally, though, when it seemed I could hold my breath no longer, I found the exit and shot out into the city air, never more grateful for it. I bent over double, and before I could stand up, a body came flying into me from behind and bulldozed me to the ground. The tackler clasped me like a wrestler to keep me on the ground. I realized it was one of the hostages.
What the hell?
At the same time, I realized that I was still clutching both guns, despite everything that had just happened. That was definitely the military background. I pointed the Boas at her head. She stopped struggling and sprawled backwards on the ground.
What?
He told me to delay you, or else he'd kill my girlfriend.
She gestured toward the bay. I looked that way and saw the perp almost to the ferry building, dragging the other woman by the arm.
I don't think he will.
I gathered myself, stood up, and tucked the Boas back into my belt. I started to move toward the ferry building and slipped the glasses back on.
Call 904, Karen Reyes.
Immediately, a large portion of the glasses depicted Reyes's view. To show me that she had done what I instructed,
Her eyes were fixed on an imposing barrier that slid into place on the bottom floor exit of the ferry building parking garage to block any cars from leaving. Find a spot where you can hide around the corner from the garage's elevator, but close enough that you can get the drop on the perp before he boards it. I watched through her glasses as she jogged to a concealed spot around the corner from the garage's elevator, which led to the roof.
What happens if he's parked on the ground floor?
If you're right, which I'm thinking more and more that you are, he'll be parked on the roof. She used the same trick I had done with the sight of one of her guns, but with more efficient results. For when the masked man and his hostage approached the elevator, confirming my educated guess, she stepped out with the other gun and put it to the back of his head. He raised both hands. She took his firearm, then pulled the woman away from him.
I only want her.
Reyes followed my instructions by heading out of the garage with the hostage. But she looked back for a while as she moved away, so through her glasses, I could see the man shrug in bewilderment and enter the elevator. I turned off her feed and stood on the street outside, situated so that I could watch the roof, but also be close enough to the garage exit that I could get there quickly if he tried to drive out and was stopped by the closed barrier. That proved to be unnecessary, however, because soon I heard a familiar sound from the roof and saw a sleek black car rise into the night sky from its parking place there. It turned away from my position and headed out over the bay.
Well, I guess we know he's a piecer now.
The flying cars, commonly called aeros, were the sole property of Bas and were used exclusively and only by our agents. The Saban anti-gravity technology that powered them had been invented by a Silicon Valley company that was under Saul Rabin's protection since the earthquake. So he owned the rights to something the rest of the world wanted, which made him one of its most powerful people. He was also one of the most enigmatic, which I had to admit even though he was my boss and benefactor, and I was wondering if he knew and approved of what the masked man had been doing. I began walking back to my own aero to find out. On my way to the car, I called the castle and asked for a different tech to keep the knowledge of this case spread out.
Yes, Mr. Ares, this is Sheila. How can I assist you?
Scan the Bas database and the eye for an aero that was at the ferry building a few minutes before and is now somewhere over the bay. She almost immediately found it.
I have it, Mr. Ares. That aero is registered to Bas security agent Malachi Stein.
Mal Stein had been at Bas before I was, and I did not know much about him, except for his other nickname, and a few rumors that went along with it. The tech also informed me that Stein had just landed on the northwest corner of Alcatraz Island, and now I was almost totally sure that I knew what the man had been doing. I was glad that I hadn't called the other tech again, because he and Stein both had Jewish names and may have had a relationship with one another. There was a small but noticeable contingent of God's chosen people in the employ of Bas, presumably because their background, if not their own beliefs, fit better than the others with the mayor's moral values. The fact that he had hired me to a high-level position without knowing me first always puzzled me, but perhaps it was at least partially explained by my military background, which ingrained into me some of those values, like justice and loyalty. His senior executive piecer, Darian Anthony, known to me as Dee, had learned them preparing for and playing professional sports, and Saul's son Paul, who was the vice president and head of operations, had learned them from his father. Dee and Paul were the only two men above me, except for the old man himself, and it was they who would need to make a decision about this situation. I called Dee when I reached the aero, because he was primarily responsible for piecer hiring and firing. Paul had the authority to do so, but had his hands full with the business and science ends of Bas, and usually deferred to Dee on personnel matters. I also called Dee because I was a bit closer to him, and although I considered Paul a friend, I was less comfortable with waking up the Crown Prince at this hour of the morning. As the car hummed to life and lifted off from the street, Dee's groggy face appeared on the right side of the windshield.
This better be good.
I know who killed the three squatters that Harris has been bitching about.
Okay, good. You got me up for that?
It's a piecer.
So?
So it could be a big PR problem for us.
We are a big PR problem.
He would know, because along with Paul, he handled almost all our interactions with the media. This was another reason he had been hired, no doubt, because Saul himself was notoriously inept at that.
We've survived worse before. We'll insist it was necessary, and people will believe what they want to believe. And criminals like the squatters will fear us even more, which is the point of the Peacer Force anyway.
Well, I don't think it was necessary.
All the more fear, then.
I was disappointed in my friend's reaction, but not surprised by it. Will Paul see it the same way?
More so.
I tried a different approach. This Peacer could be unstable. I could see him become more attentive. His name is Mal Stein. Didn't you and Paul have a nickname for him?
Yeah, Frankenstein, because of his medical record. He's had a lot of operations and medications. We considered laying him off at one point because it just seemed excessive. But you talk about a PR problem. Fire someone for a mental illness they can't help, supposedly, and you'll have a firestorm of activists on your door. Besides, he's always been very loyal to Bass.
To a fault?
Maybe. But he's only been a problem for criminals, as far as I know, and never for us. Tell you what, why don't you talk to him? Make sure that whatever latest treatment he's on is working okay, and that he's not going to turn against us. If that's the case, then we want to stand behind those who are standing for Bass.
That was something the old man had said more than a few times.
Talk to him and report to me and Paul at our supervisory meeting on Thursday. I'll inform Paul in the meantime, and we'll make a decision then.
Okay. Get some sleep.
No thanks to you.
By now, my arrow was over the bay and approaching Alcatraz, which Bass still maintained as a lucrative tourist attraction, with almost 2 million paying customers per year. I called up Peacer locations as an overlay on the windshield, and was surprised not to see a red dot on the northwest corner, in light of the information I had just gotten from the tech. Had Stein left already? I asked the windshield for recent movement, and then saw a red line stretching from somewhere near my position to the abandoned Model Industries building on that part of the island. I zoomed in and saw that Stein's arrow had disappeared into the inside corner of the L-shaped structure, which again confirmed what I thought he had been doing, and that he was probably cleaning it up. As I floated past the long New Industries building, which had been built by the prison after some inmates had escaped from the Model Industries one, I thought about how symbolic it was that Stein had chosen this place to do his dirty work for Bass. Saul Rabin always liked to point out, as an illustration of some archaic principle, how the buildings on Alcatraz suffered far less damage than anywhere else because they were built on the rock. The Model Industries building served its illustrative purpose even better than the others, because it rested right on the edge of a huge cliff face at the edge of the island. I set my arrow down on the other side of the concrete building from the cliff, with my headlights pointing into the opening that Stein had entered, which was on the bottom of 3 stories. The light clearly exposed his parked arrow inside the opening, and him standing on top of it pulling some kind of tarp off the ceiling. He looked toward me and shielded his eyes for a moment, but then just kept on working. I pulled my boas around to the front of my belt, the one loaded with stoppers near my right hand, and exited the arrow, leaving the lights on so that I could see the scene. As I approached, I noticed that he wore at least one gun in his belt. His jacket rode up as he reached toward the ceiling and revealed it. But I knew he would only draw it if he was really crazy, because I had the light behind me, making my figure a difficult silhouette to target, and the glasses inside his mask would obscure his vision further. What you have here is a classic blind kill box. I entered the building and watched him as he continued pulling the tarp from the adhesives that attached it to the ceiling. The first squatter you saw coming out of the tunnel, you forced her into a dark alley and shot her, leaving the body. But the squatters found it and made some noise about the ordnance, so the second one you brought here and killed with a knife after you had some fun with him. The pictures of the castrated victim flashed through my brain as I made my way slowly around the parked arrow. You hung the hard polymer canvas so the eye couldn't record it, and then you threw the body out the window on the other side so that it would bounce off the cliff and end up in the bay. You probably weighted it, but the creatures in these waters are famous for sending corpses back up. They often chewed at the limbs that were attached to the anchoring device, thereby freeing the body to float to the surface. I rounded the front of Stein's arrow more quickly, not wanting him to be between me and the light, and I crouched next to a pile of 3 zippered silver bags, which were the size of human bodies, but empty. So then you brought the third squatter here and sent him over the cliff in one of these handy weighted sheaths, and he's still down there. I moved toward the back of the arrow and stopped at a spot where the light was at my back. But I wasn't blocking any of it that was on him. Too bad you have to stop now, just when you have your system perfected.
I don't have to stop.
He jumped down off the back of the arrow, pulling the rest of the tarp from the ceiling, and started to fold it up.
I'll just find a new place that you won't know about, so you won't be tempted to talk about it or come looking for me. Which you won't.
Why not?
Because you don't want to mess with me. And you sure as hell don't want to mess with my boss.
I am your boss, Mal. Or at least one of them.
No, you're not.
He finished folding the top and was stuffing it into the back of the Arrow.
You're a newbie who can't possibly understand the way we work at Bass and how the mayor wants things done.
He turned to face me now, the black half cowl reflecting the light from my Arrow.
Those squatters are blaspheming his name every day they stay in the Red Tunnel and vomit their rancid puke onto the net. We would never have allowed that in the early days.
That was a time of extreme emergency. Things have settled down now. We need some semblance of justice.
Saul Raven is justice in this town. And those who oppose him deserve to die. It's as simple as that.
You talk about him like he's God.
To me, he is God.
His mask was nodding up and down.
The mayor is my savior, that's for sure. More than any Jesus H. Christ on a cross. I was trapped in the Tenderloin after the quake hit, and my family and friends were dying one by one, and I would have been next if the Peacers hadn't come in with guns blazing. They didn't have any time to ask which criminals should live and which should die, and we still don't have time for that.
Maybe that was one of the reasons Saul brought me to Bass. I wasn't saved by him, so I can be a little more objective than those who were. You're not saying that you actually have authorization from Saul Raven himself for what you've been doing?
Not directly.
He resumed his work, hauling the body's sheaths into the trunk of the Arrow.
But the mayor doesn't have time to make operational decisions himself. He trusts in us Peacers to do what's in the best interest of Bass.
That was another thing I had heard the old man say. How's that helmet working out for you? I understand you've had some problems in the past.
I've never been better.
As he talked, Stein dragged and lifted the heavy bags.
I'm so glad to be done with all the medicines I've tried since the trauma I suffered in the quake. I could never get those pills just right. This contraption sends waves into my brain or something like that. But I'm feeling a lot better and thinking a lot clearer.
I don't agree, Malachi. I think you're done it, boss. And I think you should receive a Class C dismissal that says you're not fit for law enforcement, so no one else will hire you for this kind of work.
He finished loading the trunk and faced me.
Well, it's a good thing you can't do that to me. I work for the mayor.
Actually, he's delegated all such decisions to a team of three men, and I'm one of them.
Good luck convincing Paul Raven and Darian Anthony that they should fire someone who's doing exactly what they want to be done.
Stranger things have happened. They're the only ones who have to be convinced. And when so much power is in the hands of so few, it cuts both ways. It's great when it goes your way, but when it doesn't, not so much.
It will go my way. And even if it doesn't, I'll appeal to the mayor, and then you'll be the one who gets cut.
In that case, as you so graciously said to me, good luck.
I turned away from him and walked toward my Arrow. There was no point in arresting him, because I realized he could be right, and this all might end up being a bigger black eye for me than for him. I kept walking with my back turned toward him, because I was convinced that he really expected to survive this, and therefore wouldn't cause me any harm. But I did have the rear-view feature activated in my glasses, just in case. I took off from the rock without incident, and was barely in the air for a minute, when I knew exactly what I was going to say at our supervisory meeting the next day. I already had composed and rehearsed one particular line in my mind. Thursday arrived, and with it the regular meeting with Paul and Dee, where we tried to make as many executive-level decisions as we could in an hour. We had gathered so many times in this conference room on the 24th floor of the castle that we no longer even noticed the awesome view of the city through the trans-steel wall on one side of it. I waited until an appropriate time, and brought up the situation. That reminds me, Dee, I talked to Franken yesterday. I used the nickname intentionally, so they would be thinking about the man's instability.
What did he say?
I took a moment to respond to Paul, trying to remember the exact words.
I'm sick of this place. I'd like to burn it down. I'm sick of the old man, and I'd like to slit his throat and drink his blood.
I'm not surprised. He's on about 10 different drugs, the second five balancing the first five. You know how it goes. He can't be held responsible for his actions right now, but he also can't be an agent anymore.
Let him go and give him a Class C.
After the legal notice of the Class C termination was delivered to Stein, he used up every favor he had ever earned from other Bass employees to get a video of a final desperate appeal to the notoriously reclusive Saul Rabin. I didn't see it, but I assumed it said something like, "I don't know what Michael Airy said about me to get me fired, but I am your most loyal man, have always been, and will always be." The mayor did watch the video, but merely out of deference to the man's many years on the force, and his response was very brief.
"Malcolm, I am grateful for your service to our company. However, I don't have the time or energy to micromanage or second-guess the operational decisions of my executive pieces. I have to trust they are doing what is best for Bass."
Stein must have stalked me for days after that, seething with rage but patiently waiting for his moment of revenge, because he managed to catch me at one of the few times I was actually vulnerable. I had walked out of the castle after work to visit the Occidental Cigar Club a few blocks away on Pine Street, as I often did after I'd smoked some of those legal cigarettes and found them less than fully satisfying. The recent invention of those highlights, as they were called, was truly a wonder of chemical engineering, simulating the effects of nicotine without the carcinogens. But for me and many others, they still left something to be desired. That's why Occidental had been able to rebuild their business about 10 times larger after the quake, and had a constant stream of customers ever since. Saul Rabin outlawed smoking when he came to power, as other parts of the Americas had already done, but made an exception for a few establishments like this one, which he had frequented during his days on the police force. So people could buy and smoke cigars and pipes at Occidental, but it was only legal on their property, in the club itself or on the patios outside. After enjoying a nice Warlock cigar while I watched the end of the sunset from an upper patio, I walked up Pine Street and cut across Joyce to California. I always went this way, because the beginning of Joyce Street was a hidden gem in the San Francisco landscape, appreciated by the locals and thus preserved during the reconstruction of the city. It was a small rainbow-shaped alley with about 50 steep steps on the Pine Street side and a paved path almost as steep on the other end. The masked man who was following me didn't confront me as I walked up the steps or crested the hill, but when I was halfway down the slope on the California side. So he had the high ground, and I was at a serious disadvantage from the start.
"Ares, no words or guns are necessary."
I turned to face him. I knew what he meant. It was exactly what I had expected from him. He wasn't stupid enough to try to kill me or even cut me up, because Bass would extract a very inevitable and final retribution on him if he did. But if he took his anger out on me with his own hands in a fair fight, the worst he could expect would be a brief incarceration in the cathedral. And he probably thought that I would be so shamed and embarrassed by a beating that I would drop the whole thing and not even report it, so that no one would know what happened. On the other hand, I was thinking about the positive effects a beating might have on him, not the least of which was that he might realize who he was up against and give up on the whole revenge thing. So I pulled back on the bottom corners of my jacket with both hands to show him that my boas were on the back of my belt, and he did the same. I knew he had been required to hand in his Bass guns when he was terminated, but he still might have one back there, because many pieces kept their own personal weapons at home. A couple of pedestrians crested the hill behind the masked man, but then ran away when they saw us facing each other down. Stein opened the floodgates on the anger that had been percolating inside him. He rushed toward me down the hill. The rush turned into a low double-legged kick at the end, the recklessness of which surprised me, but not enough that I couldn't crouch and take most of the impact with my crossed arms. If he had hit my legs from any angle, which he was hoping for, I would have been crippled at least temporarily, and the fight would have been extremely short. But as it was, I merely toppled backward with a modicum of pain, and he was spun sideways when he landed. In a moment, we were both back on our feet, too close now for any more of that flying crap. I blocked a blow and ducked another, then dodged a kick to the groin. I had 3 openings during this flurry where I could have struck at him, but instead, I used each of them to move a little farther to his side, so we would be in a more even position on the steep hill. I think this was the key to the whole fight, because if I would have retaliated while staying below him, he could have taken me out. Maybe. But thankfully, my special forces training, which he didn't have, included tactical strategy. I was able to think before I hit. The next block was with my right forearm, and was followed by a battering ram of my elbow to the center of his mask and the upper half of his face. I drove the sharp point of my elbow into it with the force from my upper arm, shoulder, back, and my whole body as I turned into the blow. Stein's mask was split in two places as he staggered back, and a piece of it hung loose like it was about to fall off. And it did fall off when he shook his head as if he was trying to clear his mind. Then he surprised me again by diving headfirst into my midsection, driving us both to the ground. This was, of course, a big mistake, because now I was connected with the ground and had all the leverage. I smashed the side of his head with the same kind of upper arm shiver and brought my knee up into his crotch at the same time, which weakened his grip and sent him rolling down the hill about 5 feet. I made my first mistake by standing up right away to show him I was unhurt, instead of watching him closely. He must have realized he couldn't win, because when he rolled over onto his back, he proved to be more stupid than I had thought by coming up with a gun in his hand. However, before he could fire, the X of a stopper round slammed into his arm. Karen Reyes was standing near the top of the hill with her own gun pointed at the man, who was now holding his injured arm and rocking back and forth in pain. When he got over the initial shock of being shot and looked at me, I patted the front pocket of my jacket, where my glasses were sticking out just enough to be filming whatever was in front of me.
"She's been monitoring me when I go out,"
I shrugged my shoulders as I gestured toward Reyes.
"I don't mind a fair fight, but only with equals. You can leave, but if I see you again, there'll be no mutual sparring. Just a bad case of police brutality."
About a week later, Paul forwarded me a net clip of Harris interviewing the latest addition to the squatters' ranks.
"You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. And the world is changing, friends. Hellboy Harris here with our new friend Mal Stein, who after 15 years as a bass piecer, insert laughter, finally had enough of the bloody tyranny at the Fortress of Intolerance and decided to join the good guys."
At first I was surprised by this, but then I wasn't, as I thought about it more.
"So tell us, Mal man. You used to be on the steady diet of hate muffins toward the brothers and sisters here in the Red Tunnel. But now, we are family. Get up, everybody, and sing. What happened?"
"I realize what you've been saying about Bass is all true."
He wasn't wearing anything on his shaved head, except for some new tattoos, to match the other new ones on his nearly naked body. I wondered if he'd been trying some new kind of medication that he hadn't been allowed to use while employed by us, because he seemed at least a bit stoned.
"You are a prophet, and a real hero, Brother Harris. The bravery you have shown by standing up to the man is without peer."
"I feel like one of the blushing brides."
I didn't hear much of the rest of the interview, because I was trying to remember a famous quote by the activist Wan Cheng about "when my God doesn't believe in me," or something like that. I looked up the English translation in a second window in my glasses and found it. "There is no finer line between love and hate than for whatever we worship. Blind devotion is driven more by the needs of the devotee than the quality of the object. A god who rejects you can easily become a devil to you, and a devil your god." That was even more appropriate than I'd expected. As I closed both windows and this brief chapter in my life, I glanced at the note Paul had appended to the video link.
"Frankenstein, indeed. We created a monster."
Unmasked, a prequel short story, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2012 by David Swavely. Published by arrangement with Thomas Dunn Books, an imprint of St. Martin's Press, LLC. All rights reserved. Copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication prohibited. Performed by Ken Jackson, Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, Colleen Delaney, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, Elizabeth Jernigan, Evan Casey, and Jeff Baker. Original music, dialogue editing, and graphic audio sound design by Thomas Hogan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed this story, look for Dave Swavely's The Piecer Series, Book 1, Silhouette. Coming soon from Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can select from over 900 titles and 60 series in either CD or high-quality download formats. If you would like to listen to an entire series, you can conveniently purchase the whole sets on CD or USB flash drive from graphicaudio.net. At graphicaudio.net, you can now earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable toward future online purchases. You can also get full mobile downloads directly to your phone or tablet with our new Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices, so you can listen on the go, anytime, anywhere. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our email newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.